Hey everyone, a couple of announcements before jumping into the pod. First, next week for Startup Week, we'll be running a breakfast special. Get anything from our breakfast menu and get a cup of coffee for just a dollar from open until 11 a.m. Startup Week means one thing. You're going, going, and going, full of late nights and early mornings. So we want to help keep you ready for your day. So come by and fill up for breakfast and don't miss any of the great events happening all over our city. Second, on Monday of Startup Week, I'll be part of an event on, you guessed it, podcasting. The event is called Podcasting for Business, and I'll be on a panel with three other incredible local podcasters, and we'll be talking about the entire process of podcasting, from equipment to marketing to editing, you name it. So that's going to be Monday, October 16th at 2 p.m. at the Pavilion in Miller Plaza. So I hope to see you there and would love to get the chance to meet all of you. All right, that's it. Now on to this week's episode.
It was me riding around without talking to anybody that lived or worked there to identify the most concerning issues in the area that I patrolled.
Yeah.
Well, that's not community policing. That's right. Just me paying attention to other stuff is all it is.
Yeah.
So when we talk about community policing, the word community is left in there deliberately because it is involving the community, but we look at it as a problem-solving policing,
right,
which is where we deliberately have the conversations for the community to tell us what is most important to them. Because I'd come in and solve 15 things today. But yeah, if I didn't solve the 16th one that everybody was truly concerned about, did I really address fear and crime in the area? I didn't. So that's where when we go into the problem-solving approach, which is what we have trained all of our officers on, how to understand the models, encourage people to get out and work with that at all levels of the police department. That's what creates the change. So to me, it's very important that when we mention community policing, we keep it tied to problem-solving policing, because that's really what people come to the police department for.
David Roddy is the newly elected chief of the Chattanooga Police Department. In this episode, we get to know the new chief and continue a conversation that began with his predecessor, Fred Fletcher, on community policing, the importance of diversity, and the new ways in which our police force is equipped to serve and protect Chattanooga. This is the Camp House Podcast, and I am your host, Matt Busby. Well, Chief Roddy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So my guest today is new Chattanooga Police Chief David Roddy. And, I wanted to have him on the podcast really just to sort of introduce you to the community, to let people kind of know who you are. I say this a lot. You know, there's a lot of my listeners who, you know, as millennials or whatever, prefer podcasts for their information over stuff like articles and that kind of thing. So there's plenty of articles out there sort of introducing people to Chief Roddy, and I'm going to link some of those into the show notes of this episode. But I really wanted to have you kind of, in your own words, explain who you are and your vision for the department. So, you know, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, thank you. Born and raised Chattanooga. Actually was spent my first years in Hixson. And went to DuPont Elementary, which is still there. It's iconic in the Hixson area. And then moved out to the Brainerd, East Brainerd area. Went to Best T. Shepherd, the original one, which is no longer there.
Okay.
It actually burned. And then moved on to Tyner Middle and graduated from Tyner High School.
And then where did you go to college at?
MTSU.
Okay. And are you married, kids, anything like that?
Married. We'll be married 20 years this year. Have two teenage daughters. And that's a different life experience in and of itself, for them as well as me.
My daughter's 4, and I just don't even want to think about that yet. So
me either.
Well, let's move on. Well, how long have you been a police officer?
23 years. I'm actually in my 23rd.
Okay.
So went away to college, and after changing my major probably more times than my parents were comfortable with, and got to spend some time around some police officers that I knew in some law classes that I was taking. I actually started in pre-law.
Okay.
And just over time, understanding the law and getting to interact with some police officers out there, became friends with them, got to learn more about what law enforcement looked like as a profession, and got to know who they were as people and what they did in their communities. That was it after that point. My fate had determined itself.
So originally, did you want to be a lawyer?
That's what I thought. The law itself appealed to me, just the knowing rules, knowing what expectations are, but also the constant evolution of it. It in no way looks today as it did a year ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and understanding how that evolves because of the community's needs, the expectations, what we are facing as a society, and how it tries to adapt to that to give everybody the best environment to live and grow in. So that appealed to me very directly. Originally, when I was a kid, I thought I wanted to be an architect.
Okay.
And then I realized that I am extremely lousy at math. and there's a lot of math in architecture, so that didn't work. There was more to building buildings than the Legos that I had as a kid. But the law really spoke to me. Okay. And then, but when I got into understanding the differences and possible careers in law and just got to see what community service looked like, law enforcement was what I needed to do.
Yeah, so do you just feel like you needed more of that sort of hands-on experience in the everyday community versus, you know, lawyer? I mean, that's a totally, they deal with the same field, but it's almost on different sides of the spectrum.
Extremely different. Yeah. You can say that the easy statement is I just never saw myself behind a desk every day coming to work, which oddly enough, I'm now in administration and that's a good part of my day. But it was the fact that no day is ever the same. And you get to make direct impacts on people's lives. You get to see that immediate feedback of you made a difference. And I guess that's extremely fulfilling for me to be able to, when I got off work after every 8-hour shift, I knew what I had done at work. I knew what I had done to earn my paycheck. And I also knew what I had done in my community to make someone's life better. And the fulfillment of drawn from that on a daily basis, that's pretty self-fulfilling. So it that really spoke to me as far as what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
And, you know, do you think every police officer approaches their job in the way you just described?
I believe so, yes. It's a difficult job, and I think it's probably grown more difficult now than it was when I started, just because things move faster. Information flows faster. Concerns can grow very quickly, and sometimes perceptions outpace reality at a rate that makes it very difficult for police officers to deal with. But having that need to draw that personal satisfaction, I think, is very important today, because that's what gets the officer up out of bed the next day, puts on the equipment, and comes back in and does the exact same thing again. I think that constant feedback is necessary for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think every organization, whether that's in the private sector or the public sector, wants employees who approach their work in the way you just described being a police officer to understand the underlying purpose and what you're doing and the way that's going to get you through those really hard days. Because I'm sure you guys have hard days.
If you notice the focus in the police department and the community and problem-solving policing, one of the pillars is we're looking for our officers to find different ways to draw that satisfaction from. Oftentimes in law enforcement, it was explained to us early in our careers, in my career, a good day at work is where you put a bad guy in jail. That's pretty linear.
Yeah.
And if that is the only nail you go looking for, and that's the only action that you draw self-fulfillment from, then you've pretty much determined what your day is going to look like. And you've also determined what your interaction with our community is going to look like. So now it's very important to understand, how else do you draw that personal satisfaction as a police officer? It's interaction with the community. It's getting out and just having a positive moment with a group of kids in a lot or on the sidewalk. Or you actually stop and help someone with the flat tire or whatever that may be, the need that's presented in front of you as a police officer. Seek those out. And do it to where it's not just enforcement of the law. It's anything that changes someone's day for the better.
Yeah. Now, you know, we've had Chief Fletcher on the podcast when he was the Chattanooga Chief of Police. And, you know, everything you just said sounds a lot like Chief Fletcher and my interview with him. And so, you know, I guess as being somebody who's been part of the Chattanooga Police Force both before and after, you know, has that always been the sort of philosophy of Chattanooga Police Department? Or is that something that is that part of the culture change that Chief Fletcher sought to institute?
What we looked at 3 years ago when Chief Fletcher came and those of us that were placed on the executive staff is determine what the 30,000-foot view of law enforcement, what was successful, and just not just successful Chattanooga-wise, successful industry-wise, successful country-wise. And it is community and problem-solving policing. It is focused deterrence. It is intelligence-led policing. These are not theories or programs or ideas, however you want to categorize them, that we just came up with here in Chattanooga. They are what agencies across the country use to determine everything under that, how they set up their community involvement, how they set up their data analytics, what they do for direct enforcement measures within their agency. So you take the theories, you take the broad spectrum approaches in the industry, We've studied them. We studied them 3 years ago to determine how we wanted a police department to look, how we wanted to serve and support our community. And those were the three pillars that we decided on. The methods in which we approach those obviously change as time goes on and as the needs of the community change. Our application of focused deterrence, how we use that in Chattanooga currently, doesn't look exactly like it did 3 years ago. It doesn't look like it did a year ago.
Yeah.
So those change with not only as we get better at our jobs, we understand how we can become more effective or more efficient, but also how maybe another agency somewhere else in the country applied it and just did it a little bit better. And that's what we have to pay attention to.
Yeah, I mean, you can always look for best practices around the country at different cities, but contextualizing those to your own situation is going to look very different. So, yeah, I mean, we could have the same names as programs in other cities, but they're going to look different in Chattanooga.
Absolutely. That's exactly right.
So now, talking about your predecessor and your role now, you're the new chief of police for Chattanooga Police Department, and I'd almost like for you to talk us through that process. I guess you probably knew maybe sooner than others that Chief Fletcher was planning on retiring. Talk us through the process of being hired on and being his successor.
It was healthy. It was, it took a little while to get all the way through the process.
And yeah, because there was names all over the country in that. It wasn't just local people being considered.
Correct. They did a national posting for the application, which brought in a lot of individuals interested in serving Chattanooga because how great of a city we have. They wanted the opportunity to serve Chattanooga. But in the process itself, because there were several different components to it, I think it actually helped prepare me for the job. It helped establish knowing some of the concerns, some of the issues that were present in the city, but also helped me understand when I speak to certain things or how I communicate myself, my vision, what the police department's doing. It gave me a greater understanding of how individuals in our community also not only communicate outwardly, but how they receive how I present things. So from the community search committee that Mayor Burke put together through the NAACP, committee interview, which was great.
Yeah.
It was absolutely one of the best experiences I've had because it was an hour and 15 minutes of literal just open conversation. Mm. What are you going to do for Chattanooga? And I got to present all that to those individuals on that committee and receive feedback from them. And that feedback is still very important to me as we craft not only messages but programs going forward, especially in certain areas of the city that are underrepresented.
Yeah, do you remember any specific like hard questions that they asked you? And I wish I was a fly on the wall in that room. That sounds fascinating.
I don't recall any actual hard questions because they were very respectful. It was conversational. It was just tell us what you think about this, or tell us what you plan to do about community relations. And it was more the ability for me to express who I was versus the committee trying to confirm an actual aspect or component of me or the component of the police department. It was more the ability to express who I am and what my vision is. So it was lighthearted, but it was very beneficial for me.
Great. Well, I mean, I can talk us through the timeline. So you were you've been operating for a couple of months as the chief, but you were only sworn in a month ago?
Correct.
Okay. Well, I can tell you this from the point of view of a citizen who was very appreciative of some of the changes that Chief Fletcher brought. The idea of an outside hire to replace him was actually, frankly, kind of scary. We just took the police force through this, culture shift and the strategic process over 3 years. It seemed like it would have been a very bad idea to bring in somebody who had new ideas into that. So to be honest, personally, I was very pleased that they brought you on as the chief, just for the sake of consistency for our officers.
I'm very pleased that they brought me on as chief as well.
I would hope so.
But I agree with the assessment. There are times for law enforcement agencies, but I think organizations in general, where that outside perspective is needed. There are times where you reach a certain ceiling. You need a different viewpoint and a different experience to help move you into a different direction or maybe a little farther along. And the benefits that Chief Fletcher brought, and he and I discussed this the entire time we worked together, was Chattanooga looked like Austin 20, 25 years ago. We just seemed to be evolving and progressing the same way, the same direction that Austin did. Well, his perspective of understanding where Austin started to where Austin ended up, a lot of the issues that were presented in the city, not just within law enforcement alone, but growth and expansion and perspectives, he had already seen or understood how that worked in Austin. So we were able to sit literally in several conversations and go, okay, well, here's the thing that came up this week at City Council, or here's the issue that I got in an email the other day. How do we want to address it? And oftentimes Chief Fletcher would go, okay, we had this in Austin. Here's what we did. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that that became the direction we went, but it was a valuable perspective on understanding what were some of the barriers or hurdles that they went through from the Austin Police Department.
So yeah, it's a good starting point, if nothing else.
It was. It generated great conversations for us instead of just from scratch. And then also within an organization where you don't have that outside interaction, you tend to sometimes grow into groupthink. And if you've noticed, when we first took over 3 years ago, the executive staff under Chief Fletcher, the article that came out on us, one of the things that we said, the fastest thing that would get you kicked out of a meeting is if you said, why do we do it that way? And the answer would be, because we've always done it that way.
Yeah.
Well, that would get you launched out of a meeting pretty quickly. So we took that to heart of understanding that is how we needed to approach things in Chattanooga, and it gave us the desire to research and network and have the conversations to bring that outside perspective in. We did that for 3 years. We crafted the department. We reorganized some of the components. We brought in some national perspectives and connections for many of us. I think it would have been... it would have placed the department on a little bit of pause if we had gone to an outside hire again, because there is that 6 month settle in period. Who's who? How do you know people? I had to do it, Fred. You got to teach somebody where Amicola Highway is.
Right.
So that there is that, and we didn't have to really go through that for this one.
Yeah, and I mean, you're already rooted in the community, you know, because you served as chief of staff for
3 years.
Okay, that's what it was for Chief Fletcher. Well, you know, you mentioned something in there about growth and talking about how Austin grew and Chattanooga is growing. And that really brings me to the next thing I wanted to talk to you about. And that's sort of your guys' recruitment.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we talked about this a little bit with Chief Fletcher as well a year ago, or almost a year ago. But, you know, recently I heard some statistics on that. And I know one of the biggest goals of the police department for a while now, this isn't anything new, is to have a police force that reflects their community in terms of demographics and being able to serve the community. A police force serving a community that looks like that community. So can you give us some updates about that and how you guys are recruiting people?
Absolutely. It actually started probably about 6 months ago. Myself, some members from City Hall, Human Resources, some officers from the National Black Police Officers Association, one of our employee groups within the department, we all got together to study deliberately what our numbers look like relative to cadet recruitment. And then the next stage of that is cadet application, when somebody actually goes online and enters the form that says, I want to be a Chattanooga police officer. So we broke those numbers down and tried to look at where in that interstate system of application, if you will, where are the off-ramps? Where are we losing individuals that are wanting to be Chattanooga police officers? And the first batch of applicants that we looked at, we ended up with 227 minority applicants.
Okay.
And we put 7 in the academy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Not even statistically significant,
right.
Numbers-wise. So we wanted to look at where were individuals getting off of that application interstate. So when we realized the first stages of applying as a police cadet are the physical agility test and the written test, we had a large number of individuals that were putting in their application and then not showing up for the test.
Oh, wow.
So it's a voluntary removal from the process, but then you still need to ask the question, why?
Right. Yeah.
So some of it was not really knowing if they could pass the physical agility test. They simply just didn't want to show up. So we have gone as far now as where we invite applicants to come to. You can come to as many physical agility tests as you want to. You can see it. You can try it out. You can experience.
Sure.
So that they're open to come to as many of those as we want. And we let them know what the test is well ahead of time so they can train on their own. And then there were certain components of the test that we found just weren't applicable to law enforcement anymore. But they were still part of our physical agility test. We had pull-ups still in there.
Mm.
Well, pull-ups has a disparate impact on female police cadet applicants.
Right.
And a lot of us sat back and looked at it, and you know, we've done them for years in this job, and thought, you know what, at no point during my career did I ever have to grab hold of a bar and pull myself up 7 times.
Yeah.
I might have to get over a fence once, but I didn't have to do 7 pull-ups. So we moved and shifted over our physical agility test to more closely reflect what the requirements of law enforcement were. That helped with female applicants. So then, starting at the written test, we started looking through human resources because they administer and proctor the written test. Are there certain testing accommodations that we can make available to individuals if they request them, such as setting them over into a room by themselves because they might have a form of test anxiety, or is just whatever accommodations that HR feels that they can implement in the written test phase, we encourage those so we can have more individuals work through the written test. We've also done where if you have college or military experience, the written test is waived. So that helps people get through the process a little bit faster as well. We're currently working to see if there's a way to do kind of a correlation between what our physical agility test standard is for hiring and then the annual test that individuals in our armed services take, because they have to take an annual physical test. You score 0 to 300. Is there a certain number in that scale that is commensurate with what we require for our PAT? And then they can wave through the physical test, because we found out also by looking through the numbers that a significant number of out-of-town applicants weren't showing up for the physical agility test. But if you have an applicant that lives in, say, New York, which we have had applicants, or Florida or Texas or wherever, want to take off work to drive 700 miles or buy a $500 airplane ticket to take a written test and a physical agility test that in your mind you know you can take, you'll pass both of them? So we end up losing some of the out-of-town stuff. So we've paid deliberate attention to what the process looks like and tried to work through what's going to get more qualified applicants to the end of that. Another thing that we found in our direct recruiting method is we lose individuals through the process because they are not sure how interested they are in us at a certain point. They get other offers. Things just happen in life. Or they may have had that initial burst of contact for the physical agility and written, but then they don't hear anything else for a while we're doing backgrounds. And they move away into some other interest, whether that's another job in law enforcement, or they get recruited by another agency, or they decide, maybe I don't want to do law enforcement. So we're working on direct contact recruitment. Actually, today, we are opening up our emergency operations center at the police department from 2:30 to 5 o'clock tonight. And there's going to be about 25 of us in the room looking like a telemarketer.
Yeah.
You have the list of applicants that are in the system, and we're going to call those people individually.
Yeah,
so
that's great.
The perspective is, and I've tried to put myself in the cadet's shoes, is imagine if I was 20-something years old and I'm sitting at the house and all of a sudden you get a phone call and go, hey, this is Chief Roddy with the Chattanooga Police Department. I was just curious if you were still interested in working for me.
Yeah.
I mean, how much
it works for college football.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we can't do road trips, but imagine what that impact is on that potential cadet when they go, you know what, that police department wanted me enough that the chief or a captain or whomever reaches out directly from that police department for that one-on-one contact. And we found that to be the biggest leveraging item that we've instituted in recruiting, is that deliberate one-on-one, whether it's in the recruitment phase, the application phase, or whatever. That keeps individuals interested in working for us.
Yeah, I love how intentional you guys have approached this process of trying to really see, you know, are the reason we're not getting the people we want, you know, something that we just don't see, right? Like a lot of these processes, you know, people just don't understand the way that that can affect anybody. And until you do this really sort of intentional deep analysis like you guys are describing. So that's fantastic.
We also did a much deeper, you used the words I was looking for, the deeper analysis is we used an outside private sector company to help us understand what type of messaging we use has the greatest return on applicants.
Yeah.
So we did a postcard mailing. We took all the individuals that had ever applied for the Chattanooga Police Department over a certain amount of time and did direct mailings with a postcard. But on those postcards, we used a different type of message. One was basically the be all you can be. Push yourself. See what you do. You have what it takes to be a Chattanooga police officer. Come help your community. Service. And we used all these different messages, mailed them out, and then gauged the level of response of applicants based on what message they received from the Chattanooga Police Department.
Yeah.
So we can pay better attention to what our messaging looks like. So it's not just this, well, let's try this, or we're going to use this generic thing. We're actually using science and research to help us understand how we reach an impact and draw in the most qualified applicants.
Yeah. So, you know, we're talking about all these applicants. So how many applications do you get? And then how many do you get within a cadet class in the academy?
Total applications through the year, I don't know that number. It's open. We don't close the posting. So you can apply year-round. Chattanooga.gov, please go on and apply if you're under the age of 40 and over the age of 21. But as far as what we go into an academy, it all depends on where we are in hiring practice at the time.
Okay.
The budget that just got moved in, we're budgeted for 500 sworn positions.
Okay.
So staffing in law enforcement is a little bit different than staffing in most companies. It takes about 8 to 9 months to build a police officer.
Yeah, it's a lot of investment.
It is. And time is the one that is the most critical to us. Because over that 8 to 9 months, and we've done staffing models and researched all of this, and it's been consistent for the last decade, we attrit about 3.2 officers per month. So if you have 8 months to build, you attrit 8.3, mm-hmm. you're going to lose 25 to 27 police officers through just regular attrition, whether it's retirement-based or they just decide they want to go do something else or disciplinary issues or whatever it may be. So if you have one academy a year, put 30 cadets in it, you lose 30 cadets in the time it takes to get that academy out, you're flat.
Right.
There's no growth in your organization. So that's, we'll do two academies a year. Currently, we have two overlapping academies because we're trying to get our staffing levels up to where we can do some of the specialized programs that we have. So where the officers can take a day off, because sometimes simply when staffing gets low enough, it's hard to find a day that you can take off, and we keep our districts filled. So that's why recruiting is, it's very important to us, just to keep our numbers up. But we pay deliberate attention to it. I had the opportunity to walk around downtown with a few members of our chamber a few months ago, and we were just talking about downtown issues and drinking coffee, and one of them asked me that very question about recruiting and how we do staffing.
Yeah.
And I went into attrition studies, retirement versus non-retirement attrition, overhiring, budgeted positions, and I did this 10-12-minute explanation of why a certain unit within the department wasn't staffed at certain levels. And when I got through talking, he looked at me and he goes, "You realize you talk like you work for Shaw Industries more than you do a police officer." And I went, "I feel like I work for Shaw Industries on some days." But it's something that we have to pay attention to, because that gives us the ability to staff at the level to provide the service to the community that's expected of us.
Well, so you're budgeted for 500. How many current sworn officers do you have?
We're right around, well, and that's where you get into another thing. The officers that are in the academy, those officers are considered sworn position salaries.
Okay.
So every officer, whether they're actually out on the street, every salary that's drawn for a police position counts towards the 500.
Gotcha.
So that's what makes it that game of how many can we hire in the next academy based on what the attrition has been, and then currently how many open positions, salary positions that we have within the organization. So if you have 30 cadets in an academy with 500 positions of sworn, the most police officers you could have on the street would be 470.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's kind of how the numbers work. So currently right now, I think including the two overlapping academies, we're up in the 470, 480 range. I don't have the number right in front of me today.
Okay, great. Well, you know, I want to get back to the demographics as well. You know, so, you know, I think currently, you know, Chattanooga is about 60% white, 30% African-American, and I don't know, 5% Latino?
Give or take
something
two,
like that.
Two points on either one of those.
So what does that look like in terms of our police force?
Our police force is not that, but we are working towards it. The demographics of the last academy that we just hired put us, I think, at 61% white Caucasian, 28% African-American, and then the rest was Latino or other.
Okay.
So the numbers of that last academy class more closely reflected Chattanooga than any class that I've seen in my career.
That's fantastic.
So and it's done because it was deliberately addressed. It didn't just happen organically.
Right, exactly. And
it
that
won't.
Goes back to talking about that process, you know, analyzing why is this happening and thinking maybe it's an institutional thing and not just happenstance.
It is.
Well, you know, talking about your academy, you know, something I love that I believe Chief Fletcher instituted was the community immersion project that every academy class has to go through. So they're spending, I think, 3 months, 6 months?
It's close to 3 months total time.
Yeah, either immersed within the African-American, Latino, LGBT, or mental health communities. And it just so happens that next week, the day that this episode is going to release on October 12th, we are hosting the Academy's presentations at the Camp House.
That's correct.
So if you guys want to really kind of see the way that the Chattanooga Police Department's Academy is sort of grooming people to be involved in these diverse communities within our city, then come out to the Camp House at 3 p.m. this coming Thursday on October 12th, which should be the day this releases. And you can kind of see these projects that these cadets put together. And can you tell us what are those projects look like?
Overall, where the cadets are, they spend the deliberate time with members of each one of those groups to where then they can present back, most importantly, bias.
Yeah.
Or misconceptions, perceptions. And they just learn to grow and understand one another. But you can only have that through honest conversations where you sit as equals at a table, standing at whatever it takes. But oftentimes when you wait till you put on this uniform to build those relationships,
it's different.
Some individuals, you're wearing the barrier.
Yeah.
You literally are displaying something that keeps open communication from occurring. Mm. So we work to put specific mechanisms in place. And I use mechanism deliberately because it creates the outcome. It pushes what we're looking for out on the other end. But the community immersion is leading into another program that we will be starting very soon, which is called the Neighborhood Partners.
Yeah, go for it. Talk about that.
Neighborhood Partners, what we're going to work to build is we're going to bring in, and last night was a great example of who we would be talking to. We had National Night Out last night.
Right.
And many of us went around the city over the course of 3 hours visiting individuals that dedicate themselves in their communities to help that specific neighborhood.
Yeah.
They believe very strongly in that sense of community, that sense of village. And by networking with those partners, identifying those partners, what we want to put together is in certain parts of the city relative to how our officers patrol. The city's broken into 3 sectors, and then those sectors are broken into 6 zones.
Okay.
So in each one of those zones, you have these different very, very tight neighborhoods. So we develop the stakeholders, the community members that have the credibility and the reputation and the willingness to help us with this. When an officer is released from their field training section, the last thing you do before you're released on your own, you get your assignment. You're told where you're going to go be a district police officer at. Before they go to work, before they do their first day in that new assignment, those new officers, before they patrol those neighborhoods, meet with those neighborhood partners in a deliberate setting, sit down, do it at camp house, wherever they want to do it.
Yeah.
And they get to talk to those community members about their perspective before the first day that they go out patrolling. So they're starting to understand that perspective to help them figure out the best way to police where they just got their assignments at. Because they may have worked through their FTO program in Adam North, and then they go over to Charlie South, and then all of a sudden they get their next permanent assignment, and they're working Baker North. Well, they haven't interacted or spoken with anyone that lives there.
Right.
So it's kind of an unrealistic expectation for them to suddenly drop on evening shift in Baker North and be told, go help the community. Right, we don't even know the community at that point. And if you're running from call to call, you're still a new officer. There's a lot of anxiety with that. You're trying to make sure that you get all your stuff done, that you're still training, that your sergeant's happy with you and everything else. How long does it take for that officer to really get a true perspective of what's going on in the area that they've just been tasked with protecting?
Yeah.
This makes that conversation happen before they get out there, lowers the anxiety level, and they know what the community is expressing is most important to them.
Yeah, you know, and I hope my listeners, you know, as we're listening to Chief Roddy describe all these new processes and programs, you know, I think there's a fear out there in the community sometimes that when they hear, you know, catchphrases like community policing, it's just something they're trying to slap on something that's already going on. But I hope what my listeners realize is that our police department has made incredible strides to creating a police force that is focused on community policing through a lot of these programs that Chief Roddy just described.
And community policing, I personally, having been here for 23 years and worked through the initial acceptance of community policing by the department years ago, I saw what it looked like in that vision. And that was where the broken windows theory was really heavy. So the thought process in law enforcement, as it was explained to us, was fix the windows, mow the grass, tow the cars, paint the buildings, crime goes down. And I know that's overly simplistic, but that was a lot of our perceptions of what community policing looked like.
Right.
Well, the way that equated to us was, we're going to go right around, look for the things that we believe to be important and the items that are causing these quality of life issues, and we're going to address them for you. We're going to go tell Public Works, you need to fix this light, or we're going to tell Codes, you need to come out here and either board this house up or knock it down. So we drove around and did that. We actually had forms, press hard, 4-copy, tearaway forms called problem notification sheets. And we would ride around. I did it on midnight shift. And you would identify a light pole by its thing and it's burnt out. Or this neighbor's house is unboarded and it's vacant, so we need to get plywood over the door.
Yeah.
And we would turn in these sheets. And then the next night, the light's still out. And then the next night, the light's still out. And then, you know, a week later, the work order gets through because they were getting hundreds of these work orders in.
Yeah.
So they would catch up to the volume, an understandably large amount of volume, and get the light fixed. But it wasn't immediate. And then what happens? I see another light out. So then it becomes, how much are we really doing? But the thing that really flipped it was me riding around without talking to anybody that lived or worked there to identify the most concerning issues in the area that I patrolled.
Yeah.
Well, that's not community policing. That's right. Just me paying attention to other stuff is all it is.
Yeah.
So when we talk about community policing, the word community is left in there deliberately because it is involving the community, but we look at it as a problem-solving policing,
right?
Which is where we deliberately have the conversations for the community to tell us what is most important to them. Because
yeah.
I can come in and solve 15 things today, but yeah. if I didn't solve the 16th one that everybody was truly concerned about, did I really address fear and crime in the area? I didn't.
Yeah.
So that's where when we go into the problem-solving approach, which is what we have trained all of our officers on, how to understand the models, encourage people to get out and work with that at all levels of the police department. That's what creates the change. So that's, it, to me, it's very important that when we mention community policing, we keep it tied to problem-solving policing, because that's really what people come to the police department for.
Well, you know, recently I was at the mayor's Faith Leaders Breakfast, and you were there presenting, and you guys were both sharing about current violence statistics in our city. And something interesting has sort of shifted. Where, you know, if I remember it right, you can correct me, gang violent shootings are actually down in the city, and yet homicides are where they were or maybe a little bit up. And that seems like a weird discrepancy.
It's because figuring out what the intent and cause was of the homicide.
Okay.
Yes, our gang member involved or group member involved shootings are down 36%
that's fantastic.
Year to date. So yeah. The reasons for that are multiple.
And that's huge at this point in the year, right? Because now we're going into winter when stuff naturally slows down anyways.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's going to be a good year when it comes to group violent shootings.
Can't believe you said that out loud. But yes, that is our hope. But relative to why homicide numbers are up, we started paying particular attention to that when we saw where it was trending within the city. And we've had two commonalities within the homicides. One is drug involved. We have some drug deals that have resulted in homicides. Now, there's certain physical components as to why that would possibly lead to a homicide. When you look at what the city has endured with some of the group member-involved violence, they are shots into crowds or shots from a moving vehicle at individuals standing. When you get into a narcotics deal, individuals are as close as you and I are right now.
Sure.
So it stands to reason that gunshot wounds are
at that
more
range, yeah.
at that range. They hit more critical areas of the body. Yeah. So unfortunately, that increases the likelihood for someone to pass from those injuries. But the drug deals themselves, they vary. But we're still seeing, and this is an extremely frustrating thing for us in law enforcement, and it should be for us as a community. We're still seeing narcotics deals over a couple of $100 worth of marijuana.
Mm.
And people are dying over that.
Yeah.
And it's that conflict resolution, my only choice is to do this, that results in an individual losing their life over a minor narcotics transaction.
Yeah.
The second part that we saw was a rise in domestic violence homicides.
Okay.
Now, you look at that personal connection, there's emotion attached to that assault, which leads to that death. So when emotions are involved, typically the violence can escalate very quickly into a level that non-acquaintance personnel, it might not rise to. I might shoot once or twice, but anger may make me shoot 10.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're having to look at is the domestic violence spike. Also, again, the proximity between offender and victim, again, closer range than you and I are right here. So it results in much graver injuries, which increases the likelihood of death as well. So we're paying particular attention to what are driving those. So there are ways to do focused deterrence the same way that we have used focused deterrence to the success that we just spoke of,
right,
relative to group member-involved violence. There's ways to move towards implementing focused deterrence into both domestic violence and narcotics transactions, and that's what we're working into the analytics now. One of the key components that we just instituted relative to domestic violence, I think it came online as a mandatory reporting about 3 months ago, was a lethality assessment. So when we get out with a domestic violence call and we have an individual, a victim of domestic violence, we ask them a series of questions. And they're not hard, but it's used to basically demonstrate and illustrate to the victim what the likelihood for future and increased violence that they are in the relationship. Anybody that has ever been around a victim of domestic violence understands the very special dynamics that go on with that individual. They have suffered at the hands of someone they trusted. And that level of betrayal affects their ability to work through what they're in. And by giving them direct support, but also a clear assessment of, we need to really work on this and change this for your own safety, by asking them these questions, the hope is that we either get individuals out of certain situations or at least raise their level of awareness,
right,
so they can move away from the danger as it presents itself.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned something in there, analytics, and that's actually where I kind of want to enter a conversation, is talking about the Real-Time Intelligence Center. And again, I think Chief Fletcher had mentioned it in our first interview, but I know, you know, it's something that's constantly growing, constantly evolving, and I know it's something you're really excited about.
Absolutely.
So tell us about that.
Real-Time Intelligence Centers, or Real-Time Crime Centers, as they're called in other agencies across the country, probably have been around for over a decade. Many of us had the opportunity to visit some of those across the country through our careers. I had the opportunity to go to the Real-Time Crime Center in New York City, and it's exactly what you imagine. It looks like the bridge of the Starship Enterprise, only 10 times bigger. It's
phenomenal. I imagine those like Navy commercials where they're like flying drones and there's giant TV screens all around the room.
There is actually a video wall that is probably 40 feet high.
Oh, that's
and it's cool. it's extremely impressive.
Yeah.
But the impressive part about it was their ability to pull data and give it out to the police officers with such speed and clarity. They demonstrated up there when I was watching them, there was a traffic stop. And literally by the time the officer gave the information about who they were getting out with, what the car was, they had already built a link analysis of that individual to other associates, to other crimes and all this other stuff, and sent it to the officer. And I know that gives people concern over, well, they're going to know that much about me that quickly. Well, it's stuff we already know. We're just able to compile it and link it that much faster. But it also does a lot for that officer. That officer may not approach that door now. They may wait and call the individual back because of past violent encounters. So it actually makes it not only safer for the officer, but it allows us that distance to de-escalate something, so it lessens the likelihood of force that the officer may have to use in response to violence presented by the individual in the car. Yeah. So it makes the situation safer for everyone involved, not just the officer. But having seen just that benefit, but also the intelligence benefit of getting in front of certain events before they occur, through the link analysis, or where we have an understanding of what individuals may be driving the violence or potentially drive the violence in the coming week, we've already used that to the point that through the intelligence gathered from our intelligence investigators, our gang investigators, our major crimes investigators, being able to cull through that and figure out what applies to what we're looking at for that week's potential violence, then using the Real-Time Intelligence Center and our analytics and our data analysts to figure out what we need to look at in the coming week, who could be doing something, what car are they in, where are they going, known associates. We've actually had a shooting, realized who the potential actors for retaliatory violence would be, and got out with them as they were getting in the car with the guns to go do retaliation shooting. Stopped it before it happened. So I don't know of a clearer example of the benefits of setting up a deliberate system to where we can gather that intelligence and get it out to the officers with that much, and as the name says, real time, and make it actionable. I don't know of a greater benefit. And that's just the intelligence side of it. When we put in the public safety camera side of it, we've already used some of those fixed position cameras to solve homicides. So, I mean, we're seeing the benefits of this right now. One of the last homicides we had actually brought in most of the components of the entire ARTIC, the Real-Time Intelligence Center as a whole, where we had a homicide that occurred, unfortunately. Then we had video from the actual homicide, which then led to a suspect vehicle. And then through intelligence, we used the information to narrow down the suspects that might be in that car. And then we had members of the community calling in and giving information of who was connected to the homicide, and it resulted in arrest.
Yeah.
So when you look at the three pillars of the police department, the focused deterrence let us know who was in the car. The intelligence led gave us the cameras and the video and the information through the analytics to figure out who was where and who might be in the car. And then the community and problem-solving policing and the relationships that we've established and the trust that we're working to build through that led to the phone calls from the community members. So every single one of the pillars of the Chattanooga Police Department led to the arrest of a homicide suspect. I'd say that's pretty affirming to what we're trying to do right now.
Yeah, and I think that's an amazing place to end. I don't know what I can add to that. Although I will say this, I love hearing how that's being used, the Real-Time Intelligence Center, not only to allow our officers to respond with more clarity and sort of confidence to the situations they're in, but the way you guys are using it to anticipate and prevent upcoming actions and upcoming violence and crime within the city, that's fantastic. Thank you for being here.
Enjoyed every minute. Thank you for having me.
Thank you to Chief Roddy for sitting down and really doing an interview to introduce himself to the community. Hopefully now you know a little more about the vision of our police department and how they serve and protect our city. If you found this episode interesting, it may be worth your time to go back and listen to our episode with former Chief of Police Fred Fletcher, where we also talk about the importance of community policing for building trust within our community. And if you are listening to this podcast the day it is released, we are hosting the CPD Cadet Community Immersion Presentations at the Camp House from 3 to 8 p.m. today. It's free and open to the public, and you can come see the way in which our CPD is preparing future officers to interact with the diverse groups that make up our great community. Again, that's today, October 12th, from 3 to 8 p.m. at the Camp House. Thank you to our studio sponsors, the Chattanooga Public Library and Dynamo Studios, and special thank you to Meredith Levine for helping to produce this episode. As always, I'd love for you all to share this episode, and you can do that from our website at thecamphouse.com/podcast. Thank you all for listening, and I hope to see you all next week at the podcasting event on Monday, October 16th in Miller Plaza.